You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm joined once again by Hale. We are going to be mostly continuing our discussion and kind of extending what we were discussing last time with Byung-Chul Han's work, The Crisis of Narration. So last time we actually read the preface, which is the main sort of text that you and I have been reading between us. I know that you've read the entire work, and I went and I looked into it a little bit, but I also did go through the preface. I'll be summarizing the main, what I see to be the main points that Byung-Chul Han brings up in the preface. And then I specifically want to go into conspiracy theories, maybe like not too deeply in particular to them, but more formally as far as how they express this crisis of narration that Byung-Chul Han is talking about. I have one in particular that I think is not necessarily, I don't think it's a, maybe we can discuss whether it is a counterexample or not. I don't know if it's a true counterexample as far as a conspiracy theory goes and the crisis of narration. It's not like a saving grace or anything, but I do think that it presents an interesting case study as far as the very central role that conspiracy theories and things like them seem to be increasingly playing in our kind of narratological universe. I should say this too, as far as this is an episode in media theory, I think a lot of what is going on is a very, like, I'm just gonna put it bluntly, it's a very American phenomenon, but it seems to be making its way into Canadian media spheres as well. It seems to be influencing
it's certainly emanated out, and I think, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into it more, there's ways in which, you know, Byung-Chul Han could comment on this, but obviously, like, especially within the context of the West, you know, there's American culture and cultural style emanates out, and especially when there's not a language barrier. I mean, like, less and less there's a language barrier, especially around Western countries. But I mean, especially when you have countries like, well, obviously we're in Canada. This is the Canadian Philosophy Show, and like, we absorb an enormous amount of American culture and style and thinking. And so it's no surprise that it emanates out from there, but it's also no surprise that it emanates out from there because, you know, it sort of makes sense as the United States being the sort of vector of political, social, and economic power, that that's also the place where corresponding or responsive conspiracy theories about the world and that whole sort of wider situation also emanate from, right? They're kind of coming from the same soil, the power, the bureaucracy, the culture breeds these alternative narratives, which obviously we're going to talk about.
Yeah, but before we get into talking about that in too much depth and going into some kind of review of perhaps what we talked about last time, but also going into this further discussion, we should start our episode with our quote and quandary. I think I'll go first just to get us started. So I'll start us off with the quote that I have. So you and I, there were a couple episodes ago, we were discussing Hermann Hesse. Now, I think you just finished reading Damien.
Damien.
I'm still in the middle of reading The Glass Bead Game. It's actually quite long, and the style of it just kind of like runs on and on and on.
Well, you could see that style is in Demian for sure. But Demian, for our listeners, if they don't know, Hermann Hesse was a kind of early to mid 20th century German author who wrote particularly philosophical, spiritual-esque texts, quite a like seminal author, especially in the European tradition from that era. But Demian is quite short, right? It's like just over 100 pages. So I can imagine a longer novel would be more drawn out, considering his style can be quite turgid is a negative way of putting it, but it can kind of cycle on very specific moments and ideas and thoughts for quite a long time.
Yeah, and in particular, because I remember reading Siddhartha a long time ago, and stylistically, I don't remember it resembling the Glass Bead game, which actually has quite a sort of laudatory and lofty and almost vain narration style. It's the biography of a character named Joseph Netsch, who becomes master of the Glass Bead game in this academic world called Castalia. Now, Castalia is sort of this like cut off. It's like a science fiction version of like the ivory tower that you would think of, right? And the Glass Bead game is this game that we don't really know the rules of. We don't know precisely how to play it, but it seems to be a kind of playing with philosophy and theology and a particular music as well. Now, at this point where I'm going to be quoting from, Joseph Netsch, he has become the master of the Glass Bead game, the Magister Ludi, but he kind of wants to make his escape because he thinks he has passions elsewhere in the world. So he's kind of fabricating, but also I think really pointing at something that is going wrong in Castalia in the order. And it's that the relationship between the Glass Bead game, which is this hyper-abstract kind of playing with concepts, and history has not really found, these two disciplines have not found a way to really comfortably sit with each other. And he says, I'm quoting, "For us," so these are the Castalians, the Glass Bead game players, "for us, the 17th century is the age of Descartes, Pascal, Froberger, not of Cromwell or Louis the 14th. I bring up this quotation because, first of all, I notice, you know, Descartes, Pascal, he's noting two philosophers here, but he also brings up Froberger, who was a Baroque composer. The Castellians rely a lot on music for their Glass Bead game compositions. Not of Cromwell or Louis XIV. I'll just write what I wrote here. That is to say, one sees the unfolding of the history of ideas as a kind of self-contained lineage of thoughts in dialogue with thoughts. And this may be true to some degree, but material history has a real part to play in the history of ideas, right? I'm thinking in particular, I always go to these examples because I just find them fascinating. The fall of the Roman Empire and the difficulty of moving around parchment, right? So that difficulty of moving around papyrus, right, which has to be grown in around the equator, specifically in Egypt, and these things fall apart pretty quick, right? So if you can't ship out papyrus, you can't renew your stock of library. And you have to start getting selective once you are putting it on more permanent mediums. So there is and this has led to a kind of unconscious censorship. They had to get very selective about the ideas that they preserved, right? So there are material circumstances that influence the history of ideas that I think philosophers, either they don't know about them or they're more interested in the kind of ideational lineage and telling themselves this story that ideas influence ideas. But really, the story is much more complicated than that. And it's also equally as interesting in this regard.
I think that's reflective of as well of a kind of want, especially in a lot of like classic philosophical spheres, to be able to like have some kind of intellectual or like thought purity. And I don't necessarily mean that in terms of like, oh, we're only going to, you know, becoming like dogmatic in your specific school or interest or whatever. But that, like, as you're saying, the thoughts alone carry themselves, and one can sort of like bemuse and figure things out and pass along information purely like for its own sake and through its own means effectively. Whereas like, obviously, as you're stating, and as the quote kind of like interestingly hints at in a contrary manner, there's always going to be all sorts of other factors. The factor with the papyrus and the sort of recording is like a really obvious one, but it's not hard to think of other examples and how particularly like political, social, and technological mediums significantly change what is and isn't being thought about and discussed and becoming sort of core and what is being sidelined. Like something like probably 99% of intellectual literature from the ancient world is gone, like just doesn't exist anymore, right? That's, so we have, in a kind of different way, in retrospect, we have a perspective on what, you know, this history of ideas looks like. We kind of like backtrack and say, well, Socrates was this guy, and then there was Plato, and then there was Aristotle, you know, and you can kind of do this whole thing. But the truth is we're sort of backfilling from what we what has survived and what was chosen to survive. And that intellectual story at the time could have been and likely was quite different than what we envision it to be. So, and those are all material factors, right? Those are material factors for why, and largely for why that's the case. The Elements of Moral Philosophy by James Rachels, if I think I brought up this book before, but if any of you have ever taken a first year philosophy ethics course, this is very likely the textbook you were either using or your professor was giving you excerpts from for specific topics, whatever. This is a very well-known, very accessible textbook. I've been reading through it for fun because I'm nerdy like that is basically the answer. But there was a little quote here that I thought was obvious, but was really interesting. In the chapter on ethical egoism, which is obviously the normative ethical theory that, the pursuit of one's own good or pleasure is the, you know, the primary wellspring of, you know, ethical thought, right? You know, your duty is really only to yourself in like the pursuit of your own good or your own pleasure or whatever it's going to be, right? But there's an interesting quote here when he's sort of discussing how we deal with crisis and how we deal and think about the suffering of others. And Rachel says this: when the needy are scattered, the situation does not seem so pressing. So I'll read that again. It's just a simple line. When the needy are scattered, the situation does not seem so pressing. It's an interesting quote from an ethical perspective, but I was also thinking about it a little bit in terms of the kind of functionality of how we do or don't want to look at reality, how we sort of organize our understandings of what's going on in the world around us. And we have a tendency, like this is obviously taking an ethical perspective here, any sort of situation or event or set of, like you might say, a web of causation, when we try to look at how it's functioning, we have a tendency to effectively collect the bits of information into a sort of stronger pile or band or web than might actually be the case. And I actually think we'll talk about this kind of something similar with the whole conspiracy theory thing, but it's very hard for us to, for any of us really, and for especially as communities, to grasp problems as being diffuse, right? And I think that's what Rachel's kind of getting at there, is if there's millions of people starving everywhere, obviously that's a problem. You know, if you're very wealthy or you have lots of access to resources or whatever it is, and someone was to come up to you and say, well, if you give just $10, you'll save this person's life, you know, the obvious answer is, you know, sure, if it's right in front of you, you know this person or whatever. And the reality is, though, is like if that problem is then scattered across the globe where there's millions of instances, but none of which you may have any kind of contact with, it sort of dissipates as an issue. But then to reorganize it as an issue, we then tend to create a sort of unreal picture of the world where things are much closer at hand. And all the sort of individual events that, or individual instances of whatever the issue is, are much more closely related to each other than they might actually be. We have an incredibly hard time grasping with issues when the particles of that issue, when the elements of that issue are many fine grains of sand in the ocean instead of one big clump that we can point at.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this, like I have tried to think about something like this, especially in regards to, I guess we could say like quote unquote, the recent rise in poverty and homelessness, which is kind of interesting considering that it's not like that got invented when we started registering this phenomena as like, oh no, there seems to be this emerging problem, right? We're seeing more people in the streets. We're seeing more kind of poverty. Now, this obviously always was happening, right? And we always kind of told ourselves that these were happening in other places, right? And we were kind of thankful that it wasn't so bad here. But I think to your point, it has to do with a kind of phenomenology or we're kind of confronted with something when it collects in such a way that it amplifies itself, right? I think you use the term generalizing. I think that there is a kind of tendency for generalizations to amplify something in our minds. It's not just one thing to collect certain items together under a single heading. For whatever reason, doing so gives it a kind of prominence or a space in our minds. And when we start seeing more frequent occurrences of something, and it's like you can't ignore it, it's where you live, then we register a new phenomenon, right? Now we have a problem, whereas it's like, okay, well, if you really think about it, the conditions for that problem had to have existed for a very long time in order for that collection to happen, right? And it might even be the fact that the very same cause of what's on your doorstep now is the very same thing that was causing the problems in the other places where you knew they were happening, but you didn't have to see it, right? You could just intellectually kind of think about it as a problem, but you didn't really, there was no phenomenology to it, right? Like you would feel bad or something, or you see a commercial, or you knew that like there were problems, but it wasn't actually a part of your world, right?
I've been reading, again, for fun, a short introduction to Kant by Roger Scruton, who was actually died recently, but a British kind of conservative British philosopher, but well known in the kind of aesthetics field and stuff like that. An interesting guy. Kant is notoriously difficult. And even the introductory text is not like light reading. I'm in a section, basically we don't have time for us. We do not have time to go deeply into Kant's theories of,
the minutiae of German idealism.
Of transcendental unity of apperception. I was just reading a little bit about his idea of apperception and what that is. Apperception, this is an actual term, is a term taken from Leibniz in metaphysics. That's just an older form of metaphysics that Kant was well associated with and inspired by and writing in response to. It refers to any experience of which the subject is to say, this is mine. In other words, apperception means self-conscious experience. But I think the important point that Kant is making with apperception, which is interesting, is one cannot actually be completely self-reflective of their experience. You can't actually, you know, there's a unity of apperception consists in like this idea that I think, which can accompany all my perception. So basically, for me, it was just an interesting thing to think about and get back into. When we think about having, we think about our perception as like, you know, I perceive that we're doing this podcast, or perhaps your listener, you're driving your car, you look around, you see your car, your radio's on, you hear things, you feel things, your body, your location, whatever it might be. But there's always going to be content with all that. And the content of that is always going to be in like a unity. You can't basically take a step back and look at your perception. And the example that I thought that was really interesting that is used is, you know, if your perception is always going to be in unity with itself, you're never going to be in a position where there's a pain in the room, but you don't know where. You're never going to be in a position where your perception is seeing red, but you don't know from what perspective you are that your perception is seeing that red from. Your perception is always already functioning for you, and what is absorbed and operates within it is like it is a unity, and all the pieces are always functioning together. And I just thought that was a very interesting step back and way to look at how we actually are oriented in the world, right? Like there's always, any sort of subject, any sort of feeling, any sort of perception or intuition is always going to be woven together with your conscious more generally.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's kind of what Kant's project is in the Critique of Pure Reason. I've actually been thinking about going through his Prolegomena. I don't know, just for fun, I guess. I don't know why I think that sounds like fun, but, you know, it's a Kantian work.
It's been a long time. You know, you and I, well, I know when we were back in university, there was a good time at my time where I spent, you know, reading quite a bit of Kant. And, that's why I also, like, for listeners, sometimes it's cool to go back and reinvestigate people who you were really into for a while. But especially with some people like Kant, it's, you know, I kind of was like, well, if I'm going to be rich, I need, sometimes it is good to have introductory texts because, like, jumping right into something like Kant on its own is extremely difficult. And having some sort of introduction sort of gets your mind working back on the space where you start thinking about sort of general concepts and ideas. And also, you know, the big component too is the language, right? The language and the style and actually understanding what the project is, which sometimes is not always very clearly laid out, especially in works that were written in different languages centuries ago for completely different audiences, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that there are, I've had the experience of reading a book sort of unintroduced and then once I go back to it a second time, because I didn't have a kind of orientation going in, I find that I completely got the wrong idea or message out of it, which is interesting. It's a kind of interesting experience yet to find your own bearings. But just to say something a little bit about Kant himself and his project, I mean, he's talking about the conditions for the possibility of any experience per se, right? And the one thing he's noticing here is that your experiences are always a manifold of the parts of those experiences, right? Like, you can't experience color in abstraction, again, you know, apart from it being in some kind of spatial or illuminated relationship, right? And or a temporal, yeah. So to think that you can sort of get beyond that or abstract it or to find parts to this is to misunderstand that actually the relation between these, the manifold, is the condition for that experience per se, right? Like, you can't have, it's unanalyzable. And I think about the one time where Kant is kind of understandable in the Critique of Pure Reason, where he drops a real, he uses a metaphor, can you believe it? He uses this metaphor of a bird who is flying and feels the wind resistance, right? But the bird, feeling this wind resistance, says, man, if only there wasn't this wind resistance, you know, I would fly so much faster because then I wouldn't have something pushing against me. So he goes into a vacuum and guess what? He can't fly because wind resistance is the condition for flying, right? So any resistance to analyzing our experiences is actually us bumping up against the condition for our experience, right? On the last episode, we actually, Hale actually read the preface, so if you're able to and you want to hear our previous discussion and even encounter the text itself, you can listen to our first episode on this. But I just thought for this episode, I would quickly just sort of go over the main points of what I thought were the main, like, concepts or what we need to have this discussion, right? So Byung-Chul Han is talking about a crisis of narration. He says that this idea of our relationship to ourselves and our world is mediated through narration, but this narration is itself under crisis. And it's under crisis because basically the conditions of modernity and the media technology that we find ourselves in altering the way that we communicate. That's essentially his thesis. Now, in order to argue for his thesis, he's going to use four concepts, two dichotomies. So we're going to dichotomize narration against information, but in order to understand those two, we need to understand what he means by necessity and contingency, right? Information is paired with contingency, and narration is paired with necessity. I kind of have this as a, like, rubric in my head, just as by way of summary. But contingency essentially is something that could be otherwise or could not be the case, right? So, for example, I could have been like, you know, this is the Canadian philosophy show, but it could have been the Spanish philosophy show. We could have been born in Spain. It's contingent upon where we were born, right? Or how many or who is on the show or how many people are on the show. It could have been otherwise, whereas necessity concerns things that cannot have been otherwise, right? Now, necessity is sometimes understood like strictly logically, like if-then relationships, but we can also, and I think what Byung-Chul Han wants to talk about is a kind of existential necessity. So what we might today call the human condition. So the fact that we are, it's kind of a contingency that I was born, but now that I am born, there are certain necessities that follow from these facts. So I will die, I will age. There are certain things that I am, there are exigencies to life, right?
A big part of the story of necessity that Byung-Chul Han is trying to get to is basically within the context of like the idea of narration, there are shared, like widespread social and historical stories that, you know, translate into being a certain kind of culture, and that necessitates a certain kind, certain, you might call them certain forms of life, right? Like, now you and I talked about, like in the last episode, we used the example of like a French peasant living in the 12th century. There are ways in which someone would understand living, like that individual would understand themselves, would understand their relationship to other people, would understand the stratification of their society, would also have understandings around things like birth and death and et cetera, et cetera. And these were all, would be all quite solidified and not super flexible, especially living in, particularly like Byung-Chul Han uses the example, a really obvious example of living in deeply, like a deeply religious world and time, right? Like you basically have a rubric, you have a structure, you have a story, and you know, it has a temporal dimension, it has social dimensions, and all this stuff sort of is weaved together, and you might be an individual living in that, but like your station, position, and what you sort of think about things is kind of like in some sense set in stone a little bit.
Yeah, there's a certain, it's, so this is the other thing too, is when we talk about necessity and contingency, we're also kind of talking about certain almost like tones or flavors of experience. So contingent things are things that when they show up, they're kind of surprising, right? Like say you walk into a room and, you know, something's there that you didn't expect, or things are exactly as you would expect. There's a certain flavor to it, right? You're either surprised or you're, you know, kind of, you don't even notice sometimes. Necessity, on the other hand, doesn't have something to be reacted to. It's more something to be lived in. It structures all of our other accidental experiences. So necessity has a kind of binding force for us existentially, right? We find ourselves settled into existential kind of necessities, right? Which are associated by Byung-Chul Han with narration, right? So one of the things that narration does is that narration serves this kind of reductive, almost like, I guess he actually does use the term reductive. I don't know if he is necessarily meaning that, because he seems to be lauding narration as settling us in, you know, converting being in the world into being at home. But he does say that it is the reduction of the accidental into the necessary by their ordering into a sequential story, right? So this is one of the important things, is that narration does work with contingencies, but the fact that it orders them and allows them to be repeated and handed down means that they gain that experience of the binding force of necessity, right? The exigencies of your life are experienced in stages. So you have things like myths and traditions that guide you through your life. They securely anticipate certain stages that you'll go through. They're formatted kind of for your culture, and they arise from, say, their experience of their geography or the ecology that they exist in, certain kinds of weather conditions or whatnot, even like migration patterns or whatnot, if you're sort of an agrarian versus like a nomadic society, which I know that there can be distinctions in the way that they understand themselves mythologically even. But the point is that this narration takes all of the exigencies